frighten us by telling us the facts, 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 the facts. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on July 28th, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel joins me to talk about the Congressional Farm Bill and SNAP revisions, as well as a controversy over public library funding in Macon-Bibb County, Georgia. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line this week from Idaho, as usual, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start out by jumping right in on the Farm Bill and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as SNAP, formerly food stamps. So a Farm Bill got passed and SNAP revisions are still going through Congress as we're recording this. What do we need to know on this topic, Rachel?
So right now there's currently two bills that have passed. There's the House bill, which includes all those cuts to SNAP that we've heard about. It would require able-bodied people to work to qualify for their SNAP benefits. They estimate that it would take thousands of people off the rolls, off the SNAP benefit rolls. And really harm people that are vulnerable, people with children, people who have disabilities but aren't quote-unquote disabled, aren't certified disabled. So that would definitely hurt a lot of people that that do have disabilities and have to work anyways, and also children. So because if the parents don't meet those work requirements, they lose all their SNAP benefits. And oftentimes it's families with children that are hurt the most. So in the House bill, as it currently stands, SNAP already requires working age adults to register for work and accept a job if offered. Some states can go further and impose even tougher work requirements, up to 30 hours a week, and cut off benefits for people who don't comply. Also, individuals aged 18 to 49 without children can only participate for 3 months out of every 3 years unless they are working 20 hours per week. That already sounds very draconian. It's already led many poor people to lose their SNAP benefits, and then they just have to do without. This bill would require parents who have no children under age 6 and older workers up to age 60 to prove every month that they worked or participated in a work program for at least 20 hours a week or qualified for an exemption. That creates a huge burden for people to qualify for SNAP. And a lot of people just wouldn't be able to prove that they're meeting these requirements. An estimated 7.5 million people would have to prove that they can qualify. And many of those people would probably lose some or all of their benefits. Rural people would be hurt, which includes many farmers that this farm bill purports to help. In rural communities, residents receiving food assistance rose from 12.5% to 16% from 2010 to 2015, which exceeds the national average of 12.7%. Also, making a living exclusively from farming has proven difficult, if not impossible. According to the USDA, 61% of principal farm operators work off the farm at least part-time. There's also another benefit to farmers with the SNAP program. There's a lot of programs that match SNAP dollars at farmers markets. Nearly every state has a program that does this. So that also brings in needed income for small and medium-scale farmers. So it for every dollar that gets cut from SNAP benefits, two or more dollars get cut from farmers, and also the benefits that they need, the nutritional assistance that they need gets cut. So it's really hurting them on many different levels.
And I think, like, you know, if you're raising the work requirements and stuff like that, then, like, people are going to, you know, they're not going to be able to buy as much, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables and things like that that are being produced by these farmers. So, like, the notion that, as Trump insisted, that, like, oh, farmers are going to be so excited that we, like, raise the work requirements for SNAP. It's like, no, they're not. Like, either they're going to benefit indirectly from the previous way that SNAP worked, or they benefited directly because they were on SNAP themselves. Like, you know, so this is kind of a double whammy for a lot of these people.
Right. There's an article on a website called Civil Eats, and it kind of highlights three farmers in three different states. And one of the farmers is named Megan Lovelace. She is a farmer in Colorado. She has a small farm. She's a single mother. She practices diversified growing, planting different crops at different times to make the best use of the land. She also uses her time when it's not the growing season, canning, pickling, and preserving food to sell in the off season. And the requirement that you either need to work or put in hours doing job training would be next to impossible. She lives in rural Colorado. Her local workforce center serves five counties and is currently closed because of a staffing shortage. And even online training would be difficult because she is a single parent with limited time and access to broadband. So she would be one of those people that would not be able to jump through those hoops to qualify for SNAP and would lose her benefits. She has kids that need food. She shared an anecdote that her children were hiding food in their pockets after attending public events where food was provided. So her children had great anxiety about where their food was coming from prior to this farmer Lovelace applying for SNAP benefits. So if she lost that, her kids would experience that food anxiety again, which it affects all aspects of your life. So their education would suffer. So it really goes to show that the farm bill doesn't really help these small to medium sized farmers. It really goes to help large farmers. There's an LA Times article talking about the farm subsidies. According to this article, 27,930 farmers have been collecting farm subsidies for 32 years through good conditions and bad conditions. So it's taking money from the poor and funneling it to some of these large agribusiness farmers. And they're getting massive amounts of subsidies every year that doesn't really help farms. So when Donald Trump says farmers are going to be happy about this farm bill, it's not these small to mid-sized farmers. It's these agribusiness farmers that have huge 1,000-acre farms.
Now, it seems like from your notes that one of the big focuses in the congressional fight over this was about dollars for farming land conservation programs. And I think you mentioned earlier when you were talking about one of the examples that woman that was trying to sort of do sort of responsible, like, crop rotations and things like that to keep the land productive. I guess, like, probably the problem here is that, or the rationale behind having a federally funded program to encourage farmers to do land conservation strategies is that You know, over the long term, obviously, it's very beneficial to conserve the land and make sure that you can still use it for future generations, et cetera, and continue to be productive. But in the short term, like, you know, from on a year-to-year basis, which if you're a smaller farmer might be kind of challenging on a year-to-year basis, that, you know, that it could be like, well, it's like, okay, I could grow a cash crop that's going to make a whole bunch of money this year and cover any potential, you know, debts or capital expenses if I had to get a new tractor or something like that, right? But then, you know, like in the long term, this is going to hurt because if I keep doing this same exact crop, it's going to end up destroying the land eventually. So I need to, you know, either rotate what I'm growing or I need to have a year where I'm not growing anything. But I can't really afford to do that unless I have some sort of large program from the federal government that's backing me up over these sort of like, you know, bridging me across these periods, making sure that I don't like, you know, lose my farm and my business because I had to, you know, because I was trying to do conservation. I mean, that's what I'm guessing is going on here. What it seemed like, as I said in your notes, you have that this was a sort of a focal point in the congressional battle over this.
Yeah, so they would eliminate the conservation stewardship program entirely, which currently offers support to farmers undertaking conservation activities on over 70 million acres of land across the country. So without this program, farmers would have no assistance to implement whole farm conservation plans, which would result in less resilient farms and increased pollution. So a lot of these cash crops, I think soy and corn, they're a huge monoculture. So when something happens to your crop, you're kind of screwed for the year. And a lot of these are not very efficient crops. So there is a lot of pesticides, herbicides that go into producing these crops. So with that, this program would help people that wanted to kind of move away from those monoculture, huge, inefficient, harmful crops. And with the elimination of this program, the money would not be funneled into other conservation programs either. The Farm Bill proposes to cut funding for all working lands conservation programs by $7.1 billion, or 20%, over 10 years. And to add insult to injury, concentrated animal feeding operations would be eligible to receive more conservation dollars than they have in the past. So this would make funding even more scarce for farmers that truly want to implement meaningful conservation plans on their land, and give it to people that are growing meat, and which is one of the least efficient ways of using an acre of land or a gallon of water, is to put it towards raising meat instead of raising vegetables or fruit. Then these farmers would have to fight over more for a smaller pool of money with these like huge agribusinesses. So that's another cherry on the sundae of this bad bill.
Now, another angle that you wanted to hit here was the Cuba stuff. Can you explain what was going on there?
So in the Senate bill, they were adding, they were amending the Senate bill, and Marco Rubio wanted to codify an executive order that prohibits taxpayer dollars from being used on programs that benefit businesses owned by the Cuban military.
Was this a concern?
From what I could see, it's not even a concern. I think it's just the senators adding their pet amendments to this bill to kind of weigh it down. I didn't see anything about it. Marco Rubio is Cuban and is very anti the Cuban government right now. So it seems like a gesture to his constituents, who I think there are a lot of Cuban immigrants in his district. So I think it's just kind of,
well, in his giving, state, yeah. Although position has, of course, evolved significantly. A lot of the younger Cuban Americans don't agree with Marco Rubio on this stuff and want to have normalized relations with Cuba and so forth. But yeah, he's obviously pitching to the older, more hardline conservative folks on this. But then I guess Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota, I guess like how did she respond to this proposal, or what was sort of the compromise that they came to?
So Heidi Heitkamp had an amendment that would allow USDA funding for foreign market development programs to be spent on Cuba. So Rubio's threatened block kind of forced Heidi to back off and to kind of toe the Trump administration line, because Trump has kind of rolled back some of those overtures that Obama kind of had during his kind of extended to Cuba during his administration, and Trump is rolling this back. So I guess it's a hard line against Cuba again, which doesn't make any sense in this current climate at all. So it's silly that it took up the negotiating time. Senator Stabenow from Michigan, right?
Yeah.
Let's see. Yeah, Senator Debbie Stabenow said that it took up most of the negotiating time on two different days. So it's just kind of silly that particular issue took up so much time during the discussion of this bill.
All right. Well, thanks for covering this farm bill stuff and the SNAP changes as well. Obviously, pretty hugely important. Let's go to another story, which I guess seems to be taking a happier turn, though, since we were originally talking about discussing it. I think a lot of people probably saw the headlines on this, and I think that probably contributed to sort of the backlash that resulted in maybe partial course reversal. Macon, Georgia, the county in Georgia was considering closing all of its public libraries.
Yes.
And they have like switched course on that, I guess. Do you want to talk about what happened there?
Macon Bibb County, it's a consolidated county in Georgia. I think they consolidated in 2014. And ever since then, their expenditures have far exceeded their expected revenue. They were kind of, the county commission passed a budget that eliminated funding for the entire Macon County library system, or the Middle Georgia Regional Library System. And it would also, I think it also eliminated their transit system. It eliminated a lot of funding for their county health department. It was going to, I think, some parks and their public golf course were going to close. So I think this created a huge backlash. I found out about it from Neil Gaiman, the author, on Twitter. He kind of highlighted the issue, raised public ire against these library closings. So I believe early last week or at the end of June, the commission met, and there was a huge public comment section. Many people came and stood in line for, I believe, like up to 2 hours to speak out against these cuts. As of now, they voted to restore $16 million to various departments and outside agencies. So this leaves commissioners with about 5 weeks before they have to set new property tax rates to figure out how exactly they're going to try to raise this money. I think a proposed property tax increase would cost an owner of a property valued at $100,000. It would cost about $135 more in taxes for this year, and this would fund these departments. There's a small vocal group apparently on the local Facebook pages that are speaking out against any tax raise at all, no matter who it affects. And libraries are a common good. They benefit many people, people who don't have computers at home, people who don't have books at home. It gets people out of their house, gets people interacting with their neighbors and their community. Libraries are a definite good and definitely worth the taxes, from my view. And from many of Macon-Bibb County residents' view as well, based on the public comments that they made.
I think it's interesting, though, that, you know, you mentioned that there's this opposition of the people who always hate any kind of tax increases. But I do think it's interesting that if you set those people aside, like, there's also clearly a lot of people who are like, yes, like, if I know that's what the taxes are going to pay for, like, yeah, I will pay more taxes. Or, like, they're open to it because this is specifically being discussed. I think that's been one of the sort of pitfalls of, that people, a lot of people have, like, been in power, have been unwilling to defend all over the country, like, unwilling to defend revenue increases that are necessary, because they don't really talk about what it's actually going to pay for, which is stuff that people want, that is a universal public good that everyone can and should have. I think also, you know, if you glance at the demographics here, like, pretty undeniable that you need to ask the question of, is the idea of, like, cutting the public libraries, like, putting that on the chopping block as a potential way of saving money, is that motivated by racial factors? Is that motivated by class factors? I don't know. I was, like, trying to quickly pull up some of the data, and it seemed like the, you know, somebody had not updated the Wikipedia info since the 2000 census, and there's been a more recent census, so I don't know what it is now, but that, you know, the demographics of that sort of overall statistical area, I don't know about the specific consolidated county now, is like 56% white, 41% African American, that the median household income is pretty much, I would say, on the lower side. I think it's above the national median, but you know, median income for a family, according to, I think this is probably the 2000 data, so it's probably higher now, but was, you know, 45,000 basically. So definitely not like a particularly wealthy area. You know, I think that, like, again, hard to say, but you got to ask when these things, these public goods that are available to everyone get suggested as items to cut. Like, you have to ask, are they cutting this because they're like, well, the only people who use this are poor people, black people, both? Like, you know, who knows what they were thinking, but you have to ask that question.
Yeah, and I think when you put it together with the fact that their transit authority buses are running on a limited schedule until funding comes in, I think it points to people not wanting to pay for poor people to have access to nice things. One kind of outlier, though, is that public golf course. I don't know. Golf courses are kind of traditionally a middle to upper class amenity. So
yeah, but public golf courses, I think, tend not to be. I mean, I could be wrong on that, but yeah, I think I know there's a public golf course in the city where I live, and I think that's like one of these things where, you know, there's the private country clubs and stuff that are like tend to be really elite tier, and then you also have like a public option basically that's like, hey, everyone should be able to do this. And the fact that you're putting that on the chopping block, I mean, I'm not like a huge fan of golf courses. I think they're kind of environmentally unsustainable and so forth. But like, you know, again, is that being put on the chopping block because they're like, well, you know, who needs that? They don't need that, certainly, right? Like, right. Referring to people of lesser means or whatever who won't be able to get into the country clubs.
Right. Yeah. And another thing I wanted to highlight was the county public health department. I think some of these cuts were, I think they were trying to cut 20% across the block, across the board. So the public health department never are usually flush with money. So the fact that they were willing to cut 20% of their budget as well, just to keep property tax rates low, or what people perceive to be as low or acceptable.
And you'd think that being in Georgia with proximity to the CDC national headquarters, that they would have some appreciation for the need to maintain public health levels.
Right, exactly. Especially, I think Georgia and a lot of the southern states are getting those weird, like, tropical parasites moving in. So I think having those emerging infectious diseases kind of starting in the south would kind of highlight that need for public health departments to have money and funding to be able to have open doors for for their citizens would be important, but I don't know, $135 on your property taxes a year, which you don't even, as a homeowner, I don't even really notice my property taxes because I'm putting my money in an account every month that goes to pay my taxes, and it just is kind of tied into my mortgage payment. So I don't really notice it that much, and the fact that I know that I'm funding schools and the fire department and the library system and mosquito abatement and a list of things that are good for my community, that doesn't make me mad when I see my tax bill every year. So the fact that these people are quibbling over $135 per 100,000 in property value, it seems very, very petty to me.
All right. Well, that's it for us this week. Rachel, thank you so much for being here to talk about these important issues this week.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDradio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.